Well, good morning. This is Per Fagreng, and our show is Fight the Empire. Not having any guests today. We're going to kind of look at a little bit of history and kind of look at some of the imperial doings of this last year. There have been a lot of empires in the world, but the one we live in began about 500 years ago, called the Euro-American Empire. And it started when England, Spain, Portugal, and France conquered the Americas. At that time, Europe was getting overcrowded, and Europe gained a whole two continents worth of fertile land and forests, lots of gold and silver and other mineral resources. In fact, this glut of gold brought inflation to Spain and wrecked their economy, and the gold wound up in Holland. One thing that the empire did right from the start was it introduced slavery. At first, the imperial colonial powers tried to make slaves out of the Indians, but they didn't take to it, and so they imported slaves from Africa. And in this country, they worked on the cotton plantations. And there was so much cotton produced by this slave labor that it forced England to make industrial looms. And before that, you had cottage weavers who were sort of craftsmen, and they wove their cloth at home. But there was so much cotton coming in from the slave plantations that the Brits had to deal with it in an industrial way. And this is the beginning of industrial capitalism. So, if some of the issues right now, capitalism and racism, they can be traced directly back to the Euro-American Empire. Eventually, the U.S. joined this empire game. One of the reasons that we fought the Brits was that they wouldn't let the colonists cross the mountains into Indian lands. And the colonists were just itching to grab more land. Well, eventually they did. They crossed the Appalachian Mountains, and they took Indian land all the way up to the Mississippi River. Then there was the Louisiana Purchase, which you can consider was like buying stolen property or soon-to-be-stolen property. In fact, that's probably what Lewis and Clark were doing on their famous expedition. They were scouting this land to see see if it was worth taking. After the Louisiana Purchase, you had the war with Mexico, where the U.S. Took about one-third or 40% of Mexico. This includes what we call Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, California. Then after that, there was the U.S. grabbed Hawaii. And after that, there was a war with Spain. The U.S. grabbed Puerto Rico, the Philippines. It didn't actually grab Cuba, but it sort of took it ruled over Cuba. There was a Platt Amendment, which meant that Cuba could not they could not really do anything without the permission of the U.S. So the U.S. empire crossed the oceans, and while the U.S. is doing that, Europe was grabbing Africa. And that by the time that was done, Europe had 10 empires all there in Europe, headquarters. Europe was imperial headquarters. Portugal, Spain, France, England, Belgium, Holland, Germany, Italy, Austria-Hungary, and Russia all had their empires. And this kind of imperial rivalry is what led to World War I. That was a war between six empires. It was England, France, and Russia on one side against Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Turkish Empire. Later on, the U.S. joined this war. And we might ask, what has driven the U.S. to go from, 13 little colonies on the Atlantic seaboard to this global power that has over 800 bases around the world? And a couple things. One is what I call the heartland obsession. By the heartland, we mean the Eurasian continental landmass. And there was a fellow, an English thinker named Halford Mackinder, who his idea was that whoever controlled this Asian heartland controlled the world. This is an idea that he put forth in 1904. And it's very strange that the U.S. foreign policy still goes along. They still see that as a kind of a template for what they're doing. And, you know, our generals talk of a 100-year war. The U.S. is eyeing the whole, you know, really wants to rule over the whole world. They have said so in various think piece articles. One person who we might quote was Michael Ledeen. He kind of lays it all out what the U.S. empire is all about. Michael Ledeen is the one of the arch neoconservatives, one of the worst of the bunch. He's a holder of the Freedom Chair at the American Enterprise Institute. And Michael Ledeen said, every 10 years or so, the United States needs to pick up some small, crappy little country and throw it against the wall just to show the world we mean business. Well, that's a pretty good description of what the U.S. has been doing in the world. But, you know, if you don't want to believe Michael Ledeen, here is something from George Kennan. Now, George Kennan, back in the 40s and the 50s, was one of the most influential foreign policy thinkers in the country. And he was regarded as a kind of a, I suppose, a realist. He did not really go for trying to push back the so-called Soviet Empire. He wanted to contain it. He was known as the father of the containment policy. So he was not some wild-eyed neocon. And here's what he had to say about U.S. foreign policy. This is George Kennan speaking. The U.S. has 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which permits us to maintain this position of disparity. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. That was George Kennan. He wrote that as a document to President Harry Truman. It was called the Presidential Policy Statement Number 23. I wonder what George Kennan would think of Barack Obama going around making very high-minded speeches. And, of course, Obama's not the only one. You know, every imperial general and foreign policy person, Hillary Clinton, you know, talks incessantly about democratization and all this and that. George Kennan will probably not say anything in public because he's a pretty circumspect guy. But anyway, that is what our foreign policy has been about. Now, after World War I ended, it ended with the defeat of Germany, Austria-Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire. England and France, they carved up this old Turkish Empire, and they realized the importance of oil. And the way the British and France carved it up was France kind of got control of Syria and Lebanon. In Lebanon, they were ruled through the Maronite Christians, who at that time might have been a majority. This is, but they were given a privileged position. England, they sort of got what was known as Transjordan and Iraq and Palestine. The Balfour Declaration promised the Zionists a Jewish homeland. This is during World War I, Lord Balfour promised the Zionists this homeland. and they regard this as a kind of a one reason for the state of Israel. Well, I would say that the Brits had no leave to promise give away somebody else's land, but nevertheless they did. After World War II, the U.S. kind of took over the British Empire. It was costing the British Empire a lot of money to run this empire. Their economy, their currency was kind of falling. Now, that should sound familiar to us. So the U.S. kind of took over the empire with the Brits as sort of second in charge, sort of mentors or whatever. And the one thing the U.S. did was they kind of installed a Arabian tribal chieftain named Ibn Saud as a ruler of what's now called Saudi Arabia, which seems to me like a why not just call it Arabia? Saudi Arabia is like calling some mafia city Gotti, New York, or something like that. But anyway, the U.S. helped put Ibn Saud in as the ruler of Arabia. His descendants, there's about 4,000 princes now in that country. And the promise they made to Saud was, you give us your oil and we will protect you. Kind of like a protection racket. Anyway, in 1948, Israel, the Jewish survivors of the Holocaust invaded Palestine. They took out, they evicted anywhere between 500,000 and maybe 900,000 Palestinians. The figure I see most often is 700,000. 700,000 people were kicked out of their homes. They were sent fleeing over borders, a lot of them into Lebanon and Jordan. I was living in New York at that time. I was just a kid, and this was very popular because we were very aware of what the Holocaust had done. But nobody at that time really thought to ask, the Palestinians didn't commit the Holocaust. This was a European crime. This was a German Nazi crime, and they were abetted by a lot of other European Nazis. Why not give the survivors half of Germany? Well, we know now that the U.S. had other plans for Germany involving NATO and sort of battling the Soviet Union. Around that same time, India and Pakistan split apart. And one of the fallouts from that was that India kept most of Kashmir. Now, Kashmir at that time was ruled by some sort of prince. And instead of giving the people of Kashmir a vote, a plebiscite on what they wanted, did they want to be part of Pakistan, part of India, or an independent country, this prince decided, Kashmir belongs to India. And it's been ever since, and the people living in Kashmir have been rebelling against it ever since, and they've also been called terrorists ever since. In 1949, the U.S. backed the overthrow of a democratic government in Syria. That's one we don't hear about very much. In 1953, the CIA overthrew Mossadegh in Iran to grab who had the gall to nationalize the Iranian oil fields. In 1959, the CIA hired a young thug named Saddam Hussein to assassinate the ruler of Iraq, Abdel Karim Qasem. The plot failed, and so the CIA helped Saddam escape to Lebanon and Egypt, where he kind of hung out until around 1963. Qasem was overthrown, and Saddam went back to Iraq, and the U.S. helped the Ba'athist Party to get rid of leftists. They gave him a hit list. In 1979, the Shah was overthrown. The Shah had been installed in this 1953 coup against Iran. And the CIA apparently helped the Ayatollah Khomeini and his followers. They gave him a hit list of leftists to kill. Meanwhile, so here we are. What is this doing? What is this giving? What kind of a world is this giving us today? Well, in Africa, we see that Eastern Congo is being looted of its minerals. And this goes back to the 1960 murder of Patrice Lumumba and the Katanga Rebellion, which was fomented by the Belgian mining interests. There are a lot of minerals in Eastern Congo. Copper was one. One that we talk about now a lot is called coltan. It's a mineral that's very important in cell phones and various electronic gadgets. So in 1960, President Eisenhower gave the orders to kill Patrice Lumumba. And Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, who worked for the CIA, came to Congo with a tube of poisoned toothpaste. That time, Lumumba was under house arrest, and the plan was to give him this poisoned toothpaste and kill him that way. Well, in the meantime, Lumumba escaped from his house arrest, and he was grabbed, and he was grabbed by the people in Eastern Congo, the Katanga Rebellion folks, and he was executed by them with Belgian complicity. Since then, in Africa, there have been land grabs. We have the looting of Eastern Congo. We have land grabs where something like 20 million hectares, which is about 2 acres each, so it'd be about 40 million acres, in Africa and Asia have been sold or rented to industrial nations like South Korea, China, maybe Japan. And so these are countries, some of the oil, the sheikdoms, these are countries that have a lot of money now, but they don't have any land to feed their people. So they are buying up land in Africa and Asia. One case was in Madagascar where they took, I think it was South Korea, grabbed about half the arable land in Madagascar. And this infuriated the people so much that they kicked out the government that allowed this. Also, now we see climate change happening, and it's pretty clear by now that the industrial West is the main perpetrator of this climate change, and Africa is the victim. Africa is being destroyed by climate change. This is also another year in the Iraq War. I think it was a few weeks ago, I interviewed Antonia Juhas, who's been sort of tracking big oil for a long time. And she said that now that Iraq is sort of back in contention again, you know, they have a government and they are auctioning off their oil fields. And according to Antonia Juhas, big oil has got its foot in the door. They didn't get everything they wanted. The terms of the oil deals are rather stingy from the point of view of big oil. Big oil wants to get what they call PSAs. These are sort of production sharing agreements where big oil would actually own the oil and, you know, mine it as they see fit. What the Iraqi government so far has done is given big oil, any oil company, a contract to do specific tasks, and that they would get they were bidding on how much they would charge to get these contracts, and apparently the terms are not what they wanted, but they went along with it because they figure maybe later on, if they get their foot in the door now, maybe later on they can. It sort of talked the Iraqi government, pressure the Iraqi government into better terms. One very interesting thing is that among the winning oil companies are companies from Russia, China, Malaysia, and Angola, among others. These are countries that didn't fight in the war at all. So it's like, you know, we used to say, hey, our soldiers are dying for oil. Well, we're not getting the oil. The American companies have been kind of shut out of the Iraqi oil auction. So if you think the war was bad enough, if you thought we were going to get some oil out of it, you could feel disappointed. Now let's go to Afghanistan. This is the war that is heating up right now. Barack Obama has just sent 30,000 war troops to the number of troops that are there. If you include the private mercenaries, there are well over 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. Back in 1893, the Brits and the Russians, they sort of create, or the Brits and the Afghanistan tribal rulers created the Durand Line. This was sort of delineated the border between Pakistan, which at that time was part of India. The Durand Line delineated the border between India and Afghanistan. And Afghanistan was kind of a buffer zone in the great game between the Brits and the Russians. Well, this Durand Line split the Pashtuns, who had something like 40% of the Pashtuns, I believe, live in Pakistan. They are the ones who live in these tribal areas that were never under real control by the government. And the rest of the Pashtuns live in Afghanistan. And they are the main force behind the Taliban. Now, there's not just one Taliban. There are several different groups you could call a Taliban. But they are all Pashtuns, and they are fighting the people of the north, the Turkmen and the trying to think what the other the Uzbeks, who form most of the Afghan army. Zygmunt Brzezinski had a wonderful scheme to trap the Russians, the Soviets in Afghanistan. He thought that by giving aid to the Mujahideen, that the Soviets would be forced to invade, and which is actually what happened. Brzezinski thought this was an excellent idea. And among the Mujahideen who were armed and aided by the U.S. was Osama bin Laden. And eventually the Soviets got bogged down in Afghanistan. And it was a long time before they sort of retreated in humiliation. And this was one of the factors in the downfall of the Soviet Union. Well, bin Laden, yes. We talk a lot about the justification for the war in Iraq is that we have to get bin Laden, although we turned out we missed a great opportunity when Bush was president. But what we don't talk about is that the Taliban had offered to try bin Laden themselves or else turn him over to an international court. They weren't protecting him. They wanted to get rid of him. And they made this offer to the U.S., and the U.S. Turned it down. Well, we know now that the U.S. had planned to invade Afghanistan even before 9/11. This is according to a Pakistani diplomat, Naiz Naik. And, well, why? You know, Obama's not telling us the truth about the war in Afghanistan. It's not a just war. We should remember what George Kennan said about keeping our privileged position as far as resources go. One reason for the war in Afghanistan is the oil companies, big oil, wants a gas pipeline, actually, from Turkmenistan to Pakistan, and it goes right through Helmand Province in Afghanistan. Another reason for this war is a stepping stone to the great Asian heartland. There are permanent bases that are being built. Well, will it work? Do we have enough troops to do this? Already our troops are under great stress. Drugged soldiers are being sent back for four, five, six tours of duty. And you wonder how long can this go on? The politicians don't dare to institute a draft. Is there enough money for this? The U.S. is basically bankrupt right now. And is there enough oil left, enough cheap oil to fuel our tanks and planes and helicopters? I think not. Apparently the Taliban has made another offer. They have said to the U.S. that they will not allow any attacks on other countries if the foreigners leave. In other words, you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. Now, the U.S. has been silent about this offer, which some people think it may be that the U.S. is considering it. They're leaving the door open. And it's very interesting that Russia wants NATO to win because the Islamic jihadists are a threat to Russia and also a threat to China. So right now, Russia wants NATO to win. China is sort of sitting back. They could drop our economy anytime they want, but they are letting the U.S. fight their Islamic enemies. They are letting the U.S. bleed its economy. And my guess is that if the U.S. ever gets too close to this Asian heartland, China will pull the plug. So that is where we are in Afghanistan. Finally, a little word about the economy. The dollar supremacy, which is the dollar has a privileged position right now. We can print up as much money as we want. And this dollar supremacy comes at gunpoint. We are telling the rest of the world that we have the power and we can do this. A very interesting article was that according to a UN person, I can find his name here in just a minute, Antonio Maria Costa. He is the head of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. And he says that the $352 billion in criminal proceeds was laundered by Wall Street. So you wonder what is keeping our economy going? That is one of the things that keeps our economy going besides printed money. But $350 billion in criminal, mainly drug profits. So this thing about the Taliban being behind the, being responsible for the drugs is another prevarication on Mr. Obama's part. So there we are. A little bit of history, a little look ahead, and we will be back again maybe in 2 weeks, maybe in January. So stay tuned to KABU. There's always something good on KABU.